from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and Joyce Maynard is joining us for this half-hour segment. She was based for a number of years in Marin County, actually originally from New Hampshire, and now lives in Oakland following a recent marriage. Published also her latest novel, After Her, which is loosely based on the case of the Trailside Killer, the serial murderer and rapist who targeted female hikers in the Bay Area between 1979 and 1981. And Joyce Maynard joins us in studio. Good to have you.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And, well, congratulations on your marriage. This is kind of newlywed hour here with you and Lauren.
Yes,
Anderson.
I took my time about this. At least I took my time the second time around.
And we'll mention Jim Berenger, an Oakland attorney, is a lucky guy, and that's why you're now living in Oakland.
San Francisco attorney, actually.
Oh, well, yeah, but you did move across the East Bay. Right?
I did, yeah. Yes. Big move.
And also a big move to write this thriller. I mean, it's a different kind of book for you. It's not so much in the past. Most of your novels have been about family and girls and coming of age and all of those kinds of things. But this is...
girls and boys.
Excuse me. This focuses on two sisters, really, and and their relationship.
Yes.
But I guess there's really a fascinating backstory to this. You met the two daughters of the chief homicide detective who was looking to find out who the Trailside Killer was.
Yes. I should say, in many ways, this book sounds like a departure from my previous work and really isn't. At its core, the novel that I wrote is not a... I hope it's exciting. I hope it keeps people up all night turning the pages. But the real thriller element to me always exists in the mystery of families and human relationships, and this one is no exception. I teach memoir workshops sometimes in my home, and two sisters in their 40s now showed up for a workshop a couple of years ago who were attempting still, 30 years later, to make sense of the experience of having grown up in the shadow of those murders as the daughters of the homicide detective who they really felt was crushed and destroyed by that case. And so much more. I'm not deeply interested in the psychology of serial killers. And this is not a book about the killings or the victims. It's about the quiet victims, the family.
One of the daughters was quite interested, though. She actually went to visit Carpenter, the so-called Trailside Killer.
You know, the moment, if there was a moment when the little bell went off in my head that I'm familiar with after writing eight novels, it was when this woman in her 40s with, you know, husband, children, life going on, told me that just a handful of years ago she had taken it upon herself to write a letter to the Trailside Killer, who's on death row in San Quentin 30-some years later, asking to go see him, and did, in an attempt, unsuccessful, to make sense of this event that had so shaped her life. And that was the moment that I knew there's a story I want to explore. So it's really about the girls. It's about these two sisters and their relationship with their father.
And the father comes off, of course, as really a fascinating character because he's kind of a rogue and I suppose you could almost call him a womanizer. Well, you could call him a womanizer because he is a womanizer.
Many did, including his wife. You know, she says at one point, your father loved women, just too many of them. I fell in love with him,
he's a good guy.
I found him a very lovable, flawed human being, like most of us. I'd explored the mother-daughter relationship a lot in my novels, but this is really a father-daughter story.
This is also a story of divorce and a depressed mother. And, I mean, there's a lot of elements in it that really dovetail with, I couldn't help thinking about Judy Wallerstein's work, for example, with divorced couples in Marin County and what the children go through and all of that. But you've also captured a lot, and this I found myself increasingly drawn to, about the time and the place, about the 70s and about details of popular culture and so much of that era.
You know, I did not live in California in 1979, but I worked really hard to evoke it in my mind and studied it a lot. And I loved I loved excavating that period. I probably played the song "My Sharona" 500 times.
Yeah, talk about the role of that. I mean,
well, you know, that was "My Sharona" was the soundtrack of 1979, and when you're writing about teenagers, that's, you know, the radio was what was playing. But the song struck me as very evocative of the mood that I wanted to conjure, which was sort of, you know, a kind of sexual hunger and obsession and frustration and drive. And we hear it in the head of both the 13-year-old girl, who's essentially the narrator, or the 40-something-year-old woman that she becomes looking back, and in the head of the killer. And it was really important to me to have that song in the book. And my editor actually said to me, "You'll never get the rights to, you know, quote My Sharona." It was, you know, a huge, huge song. And by this extraordinary piece of good fortune, I was moving over to Oakland, and I had rented out my house in Mill Valley to a man who was a musician. And I said to him, he was a bass player, a professional bass player. And I said, "Oh, you know, would I have known anybody that you played with?" And he said, "Well, I used to play with the Knack sometimes." And I asked him about Doug Feiger, who co-wrote that song. And he said, "He died in my arms." So 2 days later, I was hearing from the author Burton Avery and the sister of the lead singer of the song, and that song is the quiet little thread through the novel.
This is fascinating, though, how serendipity worked for you in this novel, not only with these
it has again and again.
Talking to Joyce Maynard, by the way, if you've just joined us, who we'll talk about Joyce Maynard's career, because this is her eighth novel. She's a journalist for the New York Times. She was a nationally syndicated columnist, college teacher, has had quite a life. And
I hope I'm still having it.
Well, I hope you are, too. also, you have been so identified, of course, singularly with J.D. Salinger, and it would be remiss if I – and also had a couple of her books made into films. Labor Day was a film with Kate Winslet.
Coming out
in December with Jason Reitman. I meant to say To Die For was a film based on one of your novels. Gus Van Sant did, and Nicole Kidman starred in, and quite a book. But all the Salinger resurgence, you know, the movie and the biography coming out and everything. I just want to get you on record, I guess. You went through a lot of stuff with this. And you've made it clear that you weren't trying to invade his privacy because you kept silent about it for a long time. You wanted to tell your story. And I think what some people maybe get confused about is they think, oh, she made a career out of her personal relationship with Salinger. Because you were a young girl, you were 18, you went off and essentially lived with him for a
while. I actually had a career already at that point.
You were a student at Yale, yeah?
Yes, I'd been writing for years. Yeah. And he sought me out. He wrote to me.
You were in the New York Times Magazine, and he saw that article, and he wrote you and so forth. And now we know that he chased after a lot of young girls. In fact, you've written about this idea of the iconic figure, you know, using his station in life to essentially inveigle young girls into his life.
You know, I mean, obviously, Michael, I could speak a long time on this subject. I don't think there has been, I'm really not exaggerating here, I doubt there has been a day in my life for 40 years when the name of Salinger hasn't been put before me. And for the first 25 of those years, I subscribe to the view that many still do, that it was my obligation to adhere to the edict that had been passed down, that one should never speak of Salinger. For what reason? Because he said so. And really, for me, the moment of change occurred when my own daughter reached the age that I was, when everything in my life was changed and stopped by the pursuit of this man. And never the same again. But this invasion of privacy issue strikes me as a curious one. You know, where was it written that we do not get to tell our story if somebody very important chose to intersect with it? I don't know of another human being who has so successfully accomplished that.
There's something even deeper and maybe more sinister to me in this, in the fact that I mean, you were 18. You certainly had agency. You know, you were, in fact, we can get into that whole question of just how much of a victim you really were, since you had, at least under the law, you know, statutory, 18, had reached your age of decision and all that. But even a figure like Polanski with a 14-year-old girl, you know, sort of gets somewhat more of a free pass because he's Polanski. I'm not sure. And you've raised this as an issue, too.
I don't believe that I portray myself as a victim. I simply want to be able to tell the story that is mine, among many other stories. I've published 13 books. I've hardly made Salinger my cottage industry. I've actually published, in my entire life, one book that mentions him and a couple of essays. But the frustration for me is that there will probably never be a moment, however long I live, that I can appear somewhere like here and talk about a work that I'm proud of and not know that something that ended for me 40 years ago will still come up. I'd say, you know, if a person really wants to know about it, there's an excellent way of doing that. And I just made it easier because I brought this book back out. My memoir, At Home in the World, was just reissued this fall with a new preface by me that addresses some of this, the Salinger legend.
Well, let's talk about something else that has had a strange effect on your life, and that was your adoption of Ethiopian children, which has also been, I suppose, construed in all kinds of different ways by many people.
And, you know, once again, I'd say it is very hard to say a little about this and accurately describe what occurred. But I'll try, because Google my name and you'll see it. I raised 3 children, of whom I am inordinately proud and love a lot and I think love me back. But at the age of 55, feeling, you could either say with, you know, excessive idealism or ignorance, probably a combination, I felt that I still had love to give and a home to offer. And I sought out 2 children that I knew would not be so easily adoptable as many, 2 sisters, Ethiopian children, and brought them to this country as my children, adopted them. And they were girls who had experienced extraordinary pain and loss. And I very naively thought that love could conquer all. I recognized very early on that I was not the parent they needed. Mill Valley was probably one of the less good places to bring them. But I still felt a huge responsibility to care for them and shepherd them through their childhood. But it during the course of those 14 months, it became so apparent to me that they needed something else.
And that you didn't have.
That I didn't have, starting with a father and a home with other children. And it was, without question, the most excruciating and brutal decision that I've made. But I am very clear that it was a decision made.
The decision
primarily
to find another home for them.
To find them the family that they needed. And I did. And it was probably my best and most significant act as their parent to do that.
Well, you kind of adopted 2 sisters in this new novel of yours, did you?
I suppose every character of mine, you know, comes into my world. I don't see it really as an adoption. But, you know, I mean, we have only to mention this, and I can imagine, you know, there's a torrent of condemnation that comes my way. And I'm accustomed to it. One of the reasons why I think it happens with me more than some people is that I don't keep secrets. I talk about what I do.
And you write about what you do. I was taking a kind of cataloging in my mind. You've written about rape. You've written about a lot about sexuality, including what Salinger preferred. You've written about abortion. And these are all personal experiences. You've written about bulimia. I mean, you come clean in your work.
I feel I want to be just sort of scrupulously accurate here, because there are some things that I don't believe are okay to do. So I didn't really write about what Salinger preferred. This was not, I don't think anybody who reads my memoir, At Home in the World, could portray it as a salacious book them.
I wouldn't portray it as a slave. I read it years ago, but I remember what he said.
That's why I wanted to be sure you had the new edition to refresh your memory. It's really, and incidentally, it's not a book about Salinger primarily. It's a book about me. And he chose to be a character in it. I think the most fascinating character in At Home in the World is probably my mother.
And you will never wear flannel pajamas?
I think that was one of my wedding vows to my husband.
All kinds
of
personal secrets are revealed,
You know, I don't think that's an essential element of marriage. And I have to say it's easier to hold to that promise as long as I live in California and not New Hampshire, where I come from.
You may even give us some tips on pie making, because she's has quite a reputation as a pie maker.
Listen. I teach pie. And in fact, what I consider one of the central and most moving scenes of the new Labor Day movie that's coming out from my book is the scene in which Josh Brolin teaches Kate Winslet and her son how to make a pie. And that is my pie he's making.
We had Lauren Gunderson on before you. She does a different kind of pie. She teaches math games.
But
I'm going to open the phone lines and invite our listeners to join us.
It's always my favorite part.
So feel free. Our toll-free number is available to you right now. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. If you'd like to speak to Joyce Maynard, if you have something you'd like to say to her, question, comment, response to her work, which you may have read, the toll-free number is yours, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways that you can join this conversation or communicate with us. Email address, forum@kqed.org, or our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And here's an email from John who says, could Ms. Maynard talk a bit about To Die For? And what was it about Pamela Smartcase that inspired her to write the book?
Oh, great question. To Die For was very loosely inspired by the case of a woman. This was when I was living in New Hampshire. A very pretty, young, charismatic, blonde school teacher with aspirations to be a TV personality, who enlisted the aid of her 15-year-old student to murder her husband.
Well, he also was her lover.
Right? He was her lover. Yeah. She seduced this young man. I may, in fact, be interested in I think there are a number of themes that run through my life, and one is the seduction of innocence. This was a man who'd never met her husband, but was inspired to kill him in cold blood. And it was when I saw that, read that, that what fascinated me was how this boy got to that point. You know, they always speak about you write about what you know. I write about what I want to discover. And I wanted to know how that could happen. And my belief is that if you create characters who have a certain authenticity, they will lead you to the answer. And I think that I did. I did not become a reporter on that case. I took pains to stay away from the actual news of the case.
But you're saying your characters cast real shadows and then they determine.
They do. They do. There comes a point in my writing life when I actually feel I am being led by my characters rather than leading them. Well, that was certainly true in After Her. I didn't know what would happen. I did not confine this novel to the real facts of the case at all. In fact, in After Her, I have the two girls who are 13 and 11 do something that the real sisters never did, but that struck me as very like what a 13-year-old and 11-year-old would do, seeing their father crushed by not catching this killer. They decide they're going to help him. And with the magical thinking of a 13-year-old girl, the older sister cooks up a plan to trap the killer. And extraordinarily, although because it's a crazy plan, sort of succeeds in a disastrous way.
We're going to go to our callers. And again, you can join us by email as well, forum@kqed.org. One more Salinger question, and that is, you felt your innocence was lost in that whole seduction.
I would say, I mean, we lose our innocence one way or another.
Not even talking about sexual innocence.
I would say that my life was derailed at a very early age, not permanently, but I had a full scholarship to Yale. I left that, my family, my world, my friends. And when it was over and it ended in a particularly brutal fashion, I no longer believed there was a place for me anywhere on the planet. You know, one of the, I always say, one of the differences between being an 18-year-old girl who loves or worships, in my case, worships a man, and a 59-year-old who would be in a love relationship is that if any man treated me as I was treated in the course of that relationship and said to me the things he said to me as he put the two $50 bills in my hand and sent me away from his world with instructions to never return, I would think less of the man. But at 18, an 18-year-old girl told these things by the man she reveres and regards as the wisest and most enlightened person who's ever lived. If an 18-year-old girl hears these things, she thinks less of herself. And it took me a long time to bring myself back from that one.
Let's bring in our callers. We go first to Jennifer. Good morning.
Good morning. My parents came face-to-face with a trail tag killer and almost made me an orphan. I was probably 11 years old, and they were hiking Mount Tam.
Whoa.
And my father was walking ahead. My dad's in the San Francisco Mime Troupe, Ed Holmes. He's kind of a minor celebrity in the Bay Area. But he was walking ahead, and he looked the guy in the eyes and got a creepy feeling and then walked back towards where my mother was. And as they walked out of the valley, they looked back, and he was standing on a hill waiting for them to come down into the valley where he was. But they turned around and left.
Whoa.
Instead.
How did that affect you? I mean, you know, Joyce was writing about young people whose whole life was affected by their father investigating these murders and having an impact. I imagine something like that must have had an extraordinary impact, too.
Well, when he was caught and my father recognized him on the news and told, like, that's him. We saw him. We were there. As a young person, I really reflected on how that could have changed my life and where I would have gone to live and who I would have lived with if they had been killed. And what it gave to me was trust your instinct. If you get a creepy feeling, leave, because it was just this moment. He said he looked him in the eyes and he just got creeped out and was like, oh, you know, let's go this way instead. And so really trust your instinct around those feelings, because that is could save your life.
Yeah, well, you became more street smart. That's good. Thank you for the call.
Trail smart. And I think, you know, partly the fact that this happened in this most beautiful, idyllic setting was part of what fascinated me. I lived for 17 years on Mount Tam.
You had a view of the mountain.
I saw the mountain. The mountain sits right in front of the window where I wrote. And the juxtaposition of this extraordinarily beautiful and peaceful place where I hiked every day, and murder had a particular dissonance that I had to explore.
Neil, let's get you on as our next caller. Hi.
Yes, as far as I know, you never mentioned your youngest son's acting career. Why is this? What do you think of it?
Oh, you have no idea all the things I haven't mentioned. We'd have to be on air for a long time. I'm enormously proud of my son, Wilson Bethel. He's on a TV show called Heart of Dixie. But he
hasn't. Isn't Salinger's son an actor too? I believe he is.
I guess so. Yeah. Let's always bring it around to him.
Well, no, the reason I thought of that was I was just going to ask you about, you know, writing about really what a cad and nasty piece of work he was. And, you know, you said this is my story, but then the kids were reading, his kids would probably have read it too.
You know, I have to differ again. I don't believe I did write that he was a cad and a nasty person. In fact, some of the best advice that I got as a writer came from him. What I did, and I actually...
You just mentioned the $250 bills.
I tried to function, you know, like a documentary filmmaker and say what happened. With as little,
visualizing it?
Yeah. Well, with really a complete absence of interpretation or judgment. This is...
Repertorial.
I was the camera. Yeah. My son is an actor. My son is all three of my children are people that I'm enormously proud of. And But I doubt that they talk about my work when they're... in circumstance, or at least my son, the one who's most public. So, he speaks for himself very well.
And thank you, Neil, for that call. Listener writes, why was Mill Valley, Marin County, the wrong place to bring or raise up children? The children. I don't know if she's...
Oh, Mill Valley is... I love Mill Valley. But you'd have to have a picture in your head of where they came from. And, you know, to come from a level of such extreme poverty and deprivation to a community so, you know, filled with... people of privilege, you know, people of great generosity and open hearts and minds, but in a community where they were going to inevitably stand out. I don't think that was the
so
central
you found
problem.
A family to adopt them in what community?
In a community that I don't say, I never say.
What kind of community?
But there was enormous diversity in their family, among other things.
We'll get another caller on, and that's you, Michelle. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
So, George, this is Michelle, and you stayed with us out at Sea Ranch for a little while.
Oh, sure, I went there to write. Hi, Michelle.
I wanted just to say how delightful
I sometimes
was
borrow people's houses to go
and
do that.
And I loved your book. Both my husband and I read your book on the Detroit murder, the one you wrote on Motor City. And
Of course, I remember that book, Internal Combustion.
Oh. Internal Combustion. It's talk about a page turner. I just wanted to mention that you have quite a history in writing about that kind of genre.
Well, thank you, Michelle, and thank you for your I'm so interested in the world that sometimes I have to leave the world to write. So Michelle and her husband were kind enough to just lend me their house. They'd never met me before, and they lent me their house, and I went and holed up by the ocean and wrote for 5 days, something I do now and then. I'm
Michelle,
about to do it again.
Michelle, I'll get your phone number before the... no, just kidding. Thank you for the call. Let me get
good to hear from you.
Denise is our next caller. Hi, Denise. From Mill Valley. Good morning.
Yes. Hi. I just wanted to say thank you for bringing that up about... It's not down in Mill Valley, but...
Not at all.
Getting ready to adopt myself, and it's really hard if you have any children of color in that area. It's not as welcoming as one would think it would be. It's almost uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I have to say that I have no reluctance to speak about international adoption, but it is such a complex subject that I hardly want to even begin because it's so easy to get it wrong, as many people have.
But you did what you felt was right, and that's final word on that for now, because we're at the end of the program. Thank you for being with us.
A pleasure,
and
always.
Congratulations on your book, and congratulations on your marriage, and best of luck to you. Joyce Manard. After Her is her new book. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening, and you can always continue discussions on our website, kqed.org/forum. I want to thank Senior Editor Dan Zoll, our producers Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.